I'm Amanda.
And I'm John.
And you're listening to Parenthetical. In this episode, we'll be discussing movies based on the lives of real people. Goya's Ghosts explores the world of 18th century painter Francisco Goya. Love and Mercy depicts the life of musician Brian Wilson. And Into the Wild portrays the adventures of Christopher McCandless.
Goya's Ghost follows Francisco Goya, the 18th century painter for the king, over a span of 15 years, as he witnesses the abusive power of the Spanish Inquisition and the Catholic Church.
When can we expect her home?
I couldn't say. She must first stand trial.
Stand trial?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
For what she has confessed.
What did she confess?
She confessed that she had secretly practiced the Jewish rituals of her forebears.
But that's impossible.
Was my sister put to the question?
Yes, she was.
My daughter was tortured.
She was put to the question.
I thought that kind of investigation had been abandoned years ago.
Yes, it was. It was, but now in these troubled times, in its quest for the truth, the church is bringing it back.
Okay, so Goya's Ghosts, as the title might suggest, isn't particularly about Goya.
I was surprised about that. I thought this biopic was going to be a biopic. It's really not about the life of Goya, really, at all. You don't learn too much about him.
No, it's about his ghosts, or kind of the evil that he saw that manifests itself in his work, which we can see, because he's the actual historical figure, and his work got very dark and involved a lot of demons and ugly people eating other ugly people and, you know, grotesqueries like that.
That's an interesting frame to put the movie in, though. I really like that.
Yeah.
Interesting. What this movie's really about is the Spanish Inquisition, right?
Yeah, it's about the disgusting power of the church and how they just tortured people for not eating a pig because that means you're a secret Jew.
Mm.
And ridiculous things like that. Ridiculous is not the right word, but anyway. He witnesses these heinous things for 15 years and war and people's lives just being absolutely destroyed. And there's a lot of images in the movie that are, the final image, for instance, could be a Goya painting in this later period.
I thought, yeah, there's a part where they're actually in the dungeons of the Inquisition when he was down in there. It looked a lot like a painting to me.
Yeah.
Maybe suggesting what would have caused artists after this period to develop into the style, you know?
Yeah.
But it was really, really dark saturated blacks and really kind of light lights, and that was a really cool scene, I thought.
The lights generally being, like, the flesh of naked people lying in the dirt.
Yeah. That was a really beautiful kind of scene, I thought.
Yeah.
Even though it was obviously awful, you know. But yeah, so this movie, it takes place, it looks at the Spanish Inquisition over the course of 15 years, and it goes through Napoleon liberating Spain from the Inquisition, and the English liberating Spain from the French and reinstating the Inquisition. So it goes through all of that. But the movie it's not just a movie that like shows these facts and stuff. There's a couple central characters, like a Charles Dickens work or something, that actually are the backbone of the story and stuff that you follow all the way through. And Goya is one of them. And then there's also Lorenzo, who's played by Javier Bardem. And a woman played by Natalie Portman.
Inez,
yeah. It's not like a traditional biopic where you just have kind of people and you know the historical figures, you know, and you're like, oh, they did that, that's neat. It's like it has this backdrop and the director is looking at the Spanish Inquisition and he looks at it through the power of character and storytelling, which I always really like.
Yeah, while Brother Lorenzo and Inez are fictional characters in the strictest sense of the word, they're a microcosm for representing the church and the people that period.
Yeah, yeah. And Lorenzo could be... I really liked his character. It's a really good one.
You didn't like his character.
Yeah, no. I think he could be like a classic villain or something.
You liked how well his character was written, I'm sure.
Yeah. He'd be like a classic villain, you know? He's like he's really well written, and he's really evil, and he's
despicable.
Yeah. He's a really good character, and there's a scene where... So he's with the church, and he kind of just goes between whoever he wants to be with.
He's very opportunistic.
Yeah.
I think an example, or kind of a litmus test for how well a movie is written, is if there's a scene somewhere in there where John and I gleefully whip our heads around to look at each other to make sure the other one is getting it, because it's so layered and just built perfectly. And there's a scene where Brother Lorenzo is finally maybe about to get some justice after he's been just an absolute heel this entire time.
They want him to prove, or they want to show him that under torture he would confess to anything.
Because their daughter is Inez, and she's been tortured and admitted to being a Jew. And it goes from thinking it's one of those standard scenes where a family tries to desperately make him see his evil ways, but he's just like, no thanks. But they are like, no, we're going to make you see your evil ways, dude. And I love a movie where there actually is some kind of justice, even for a moment, for the really awful characters. So the writing is pretty masterful. The direction is also masterful. I love, there's a lot of showing and not telling. By Milos Forman
that's part of the writing too, but you know, this whole movie, it's not characters just talking, you know, it doesn't matter what the characters say. Almost, you could give me a list in this movie of what the characters did. They did this, they did this, they did this, and that will describe accurately the entire movie and get all of the themes and meaning and everything across to you with no dialogue, you know. Because a lot of movies kind of chicken out and they just have the characters talk about crap. But this movie just has them do stuff. And it's very exciting when characters do stuff. And I just wish characters would do stuff more.
Instead of say stuff.
Yeah, because it's so cool, you know?
There's a scene that is the best character establishing scene I've ever witnessed. Where it's establishing Randy Quaid as the King of France. And there's like a 45-second scene where this little cart rips up and dumps a dead sheep in some mud, really unceremoniously. And then a bunch of birds swoop down and start eating the sheep, and then they're getting shot. And then it shows Randy Quaid, like, 10 feet away in his pantaloons. And all of his little cronies are holding a loaded gun so that they can hand him a loaded gun one after the other, and he doesn't have to wait for them to be reloaded. And he's just shooting at these birds that are eating this dead sheep.
No words.
No, there's no dialogue at all.
And I know his character better than I know so many characters in movies, you know, and it's this minute and a half long scene or whatever.
It's a great
scene.
And
his character is completely established.
Yeah.
It's excellent.
One other thing I wanted to say about the direction that was unexpected, but that I did like, was all of the performances in this movie are really gentle, even though there's a lot of awful things going on.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of... I mean, there's accusations, there's torture, there's people telling other people you're horrible and should be ashamed of yourself, but there's minimal to no yelling.
I especially noticed this in Bardem's character, who played it cool as a cucumber, even when he was sentencing people to get tortured and misraping people and all these things.
Yeah, he's just
things.
Like smiling and talking in this in this really gentle voice the whole time, and I hated every second of it.
But so all the other characters did it too, though?
Yeah, Goya, Inez's dad, Inez has been through heinous, goes through horrible, horrible things, and she just kind of like floats around, and it really shows the banality of evil, and the kind of senselessness of it, that all these people are just normal people and talking to each other while these horrifying things are going on.
I'm gonna
So how the theme of this movie tended to evolve, the way I thought about it anyway, was the so at first Lorenzo is a bad dude, and the church is bad, and then when the French are invading and taking down the church, it's cool and it's good and it's like exciting because the Inquisition is going to stop. But then the French are no better. And that's made very, very clear through the direction. The French are killing a lot of people that don't need to be killed. And kind of immediately, like I said, Lorenzo is with the French and is kind of giving them commands somehow. He's like giving them tips and stuff and siding with them already. So then the French are bad. And then when the English come through and liberate from the French, it's like, oh, yeah, it's good. And then this Inquisition is put back into power and the people in power once again are bad. And that's the theme that it kind of ended with, is that whoever's in power, the power shifts three times in this movie, and whoever is in power
abuses it.
Yeah. So yeah. I thought that was really cool. And Lorenzo acts as a surrogate, or I guess as a as an avatar for that. He personifies it as a person, which I think is good, because it's kind of a hard thing to wrap your head around. Maybe it's kind of abstract. Oh, whoever is in power, what really is power, and who is in power? So this movie gives you Lorenzo, who is a person. And Lorenzo, just because he constantly goes between sides, is always on the side of power, and he's the constant driving force of pain in Goya's life and Inez's life.
And there's the element of,
so it gives you a, you know, like an actual physical like avatar in Lorenzo to deliver that theme through, as well as the story as a whole.
It also, saying one thing and doing another is Brother Lorenzo's kind of MO, where he calls it, you know, protecting Catholicism, and what it is torturing innocent people, while what the French call liberation is a bunch of soldiers murdering innocent people and raping women and things.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, Brother Lorenzo is the, you're right, the manifestation or personification of what people in power do to appear, or maybe, I don't know, salve their own.
He's actually, do you think he's actually feels guilty about stuff?
It might just be that Javier Bardem does a really awesome job at giving depth to his performance, but I mean, he knows he's a scumbag.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps it up because it's getting him money.
Oh, there was in the script, though. But there is part one. There are parts in the scripts that reveal, you know, it's more than just Bardem. There are parts in the scripts that show that he is not comfortable with what he's doing. I forgot about those, but they're there.
And he,
so it's supported.
And
by
at
the
end, the very end, when he's given yet another chance to be a weasel and go back and double cross, he doesn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some reason he doesn't do it.
Maybe he's just tired of it.
Yeah.
He can't do it anymore. It's not good for the,
because the last image it gives him is nice. Is him being kind.
Yeah.
Because he smiles at the baby.
So you want to give it a review? Or a rating?
A.
All right. I had a B here. I was going to give it a B, but after talking about it just now, good. It's a lot deeper, I guess, and it's very intelligently constructed, more so than even when I was watching it.
There's a lot to chew on.
Yeah, so I give it an A, too. I think it kind of gets it kind of gets a little muddy, maybe, near the end. You don't think so?
Nah.
No? All right.
No,
all
right. I liked every second of this movie.
All right. That's fine. I did like the first half a
little more. It's fine. I'm not asking for permission.
I did like the first half a little more.
I thought the ending was really great.
The ending's really good. But
no, and I liked everything with Inez looking for her daughter. No, I liked the whole movie.
All right.
A.
I think we agree, right? Both give it A's. Yeah.
Yes.
Love and Mercy focuses on Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys during two periods in his life, the making of Pet Sounds in the 60s and his struggles with mental illness, and a domineering psychologist in the 90s.
Remember, it's the higher octave on the upbeats in the bridge.
Hey, Brian.
I love that.
Brian.
Yeah.
I think you might have screwed up here.
Really? Let me see.
Well, you've got Lyle playing in D and the rest of us are in A major.
Yeah, that's right.
How does that work? Two bass lines and two different keys?
Well, it works in my head. I mean, it's all playing in my head, the orchestration and the five vocal parts. I think it's going to work. Let's try it.
Hal, here's how I want you to do it. Boom, 2, 3, 4, ba-doom. So it's the first beat on the last bar of the intro. Boom, 2, 3, 4, ba-doom.
So when we picked up this movie, the cover is Paul Dano and John Cusack. And John asked, is John Cusack older Brian Wilson? And I said, no way, Jose. That's just a stupid thing that you just said. Because all I ever hear about is Paul Dano's Brian Wilson. And it turns out John was correct. This is kind of a non-linear movie jumping between the two periods in his life. And one is played by the younger one, obviously, is played by Paul Dano. And the older one is John Cusack. And John Cusack does a really good job. And nobody talks about it.
Yeah, his character's like in the late 80s or like early 90s. When is his character?
It's in the, it's late 80s, early 90s. Mostly early 90s.
Yeah. I didn't know much about Brian Wilson, actually, before he watched this movie. I think I learned a lot about him. So I don't know what else you could ask for a biopic, I guess.
I mean, neither of us even knew the Beach Boys was brothers.
Yeah. I really like the scenes where, actually, I like the scenes in the past when he was, so the scenes with Paul Dano, he's recording Pet Sounds, and I really like those scenes more than the scenes of the 90s Brian Wilson. They had about the same amount of time, didn't they?
They did. It was about half and half.
Yeah, I would have preferred it to stick to the Paul Dano's like younger recording days.
That might be the reason everybody talks about Paul Dano only. Is because
his scenes are cool.
Yeah, right? The cooler scenes are, and it's a little more stylish in general when we're in the
Everything I remember 60s. Really is like it's like all the really creative cool stuff was in the when he's recording Pet Sounds, and the like psychiatrist stuff is a good drama film, but it's not really the same style as the stuff when he's recording Pet Sounds. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, it's a really straightforward, I guess, drama. Like a romantic drama, in fact. You know?
Yeah.
Which is okay. But, I don't know, I guess, I guess it's kind of interesting that it went half and half. Where it's like, because the Pet Sound stuff is more creative Brian Wilson. And the 90s Brian Wilson is more somber Brian Wilson. You know? So it's kind of interesting for it to be like that, I guess. I would have preferred it to be in the past.
That they should have more interestingly, I don't know why I'm saying they. I suppose I'm talking about the director and the writer.
Yeah.
I don't think that the two timelines meaningfully inform each other.
No, I agree with that.
They could be two separate movies, and
exactly.
One is about early Brian Wilson, and then that's its own movie. And then you can be like, oh, there's also a different biopic about older Brian Wilson when he's dealing with that insane psychologist.
That's exactly how I felt just now when I was talking about it. It was like, you know, it could have just literally pulled that out and been his own little movie.
Because there's parallels. Like, Brian Wilson always has, in the younger Brian Wilson, the domineering voice in his head is his father. And in the older Brian Wilson, it's his psychologist. But
didn't draw the parallel with it.
No.
Yeah.
It didn't ever meaningfully,
looked at how he's always been controlled.
Yeah.
His whole life.
Why he's susceptible to control, what it is about him that, but it never.
Yeah. I wonder, maybe the script did do that, but the direction didn't make it clear or something. Possibly.
I don't know, because I think the script was a little lackluster in general.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I thought the dialogue was pretty standard, and the characters were kind of one-dimensional. Brian Wilson had a lot of attention paid to him. But then, like, the psychologist was almost
a cartoon.
Yeah, instead of sinister, and this guy who is manipulative and knows how to take advantage of a weak person, he just sort of evil and, like hides in dark rooms listening to people while they speak and stuff. It got a little too much. And then also there's in the 60s, there's a kind of villain in this band member that's like, just pop songs, just crappy pop songs, and that's all. And I hate you. I hate you, Brian Wilson. And he's not ever, he has no character at all. He's just there to be a douchebag.
Well, I think that's, that, you know, that's kind of interesting, though, because I would, you know, when I was reading about the Beach Boys after we watched this movie, that character is known among fans as like a bad guy. So it's kind of like the movie kind of chose to feed into that narrative, I guess. I don't, you know, I'm not that familiar, I guess, with it. Also, I don't know if it's a, I don't, if that's a good or bad thing, you know, whatever. But the movie definitely fed into that narrative of Brian Wilson is God, and that guy is kind of a bad guy.
The devil.
Yeah. So, you know, it's, in that way, I guess it's kind of for Beach Boys fans who would understand who that character was. We kind of came in unprepared, I guess, on that front. But, yeah,
It did get us listening to the Beach Boys, though.
Yeah, there's really, obviously really good music here.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, when he's, my favorite scenes in the movie, and I wish there were more of them, is when he is actually producing the music. And it shows, like, how he produces it, how he's running around, how he's, you know, he has all the band people there, and they'll do little stuff with their instruments that gives him new ideas, and they quickly expand upon that, and he'll be, like, running around and telling each person in the band what to do, and they're all trying to play it, and you can hear, like, the song that, you know, we know, because we've heard it as it's already been finished, you know? But it's really exciting. This, they did a really good job in those scenes where he's running around and forming those songs, because we know the end goal. And it's funny, I guess, and interesting to hear what the song might have sounded like before it was its final form that we hear on the album, you know?
Yeah, I liked those scenes a lot, too.
Those are really exciting scenes. And also, I really liked when he'll be, like, hearing the music in his head and stuff. Those are really cool scenes, and I don't know, I just think it did a really good job of exploring how a visionary god would have heard the world and made this music. So do you want to give it a rating?
My favorite thing about it was the performances.
Mm.
All the performances were really excellent. Giamatti and Cusack and Dano. But I really wish they'd drawn more meaning out of the non-linear jumping back and forth. So I guess I'll give it, I think it's a C, actually.
Okay. I give it a B because I really like music, I guess. And I just wish there was more, either expand upon those themes, you know, make them more connected, or give me more, you know, just make it all about Brian Wilson of the 60s and give me more of those producing scenes.
Yeah.
That would have been a really cool movie, too. Instead, it was cut in half, and yeah.
Into the Wild follows the story of Christopher McCandless, also known as Alexander Supertramp, as he leaves his cushy life at home to rough it across the United States.
What's your fascination with all that stuff?
I'm going to Alaska.
Alaska, Alaska?
Alaska, Alaska. I'm gonna be all the way out there, all the way. No map, no axe, no nothing. Just be out there in it. You know, big mountains, rivers, sky, game. Just be out there in it, you know, in the wild. You know?
In the wild.
Just wild.
Yes. Just, what are you doing when we're there? Now you're in the wild, what are you doing?
You're just living, man. You're just there in that moment, in that special place and time.
Yeah.
Maybe when I get back, I can write a book about my travels. Why you know, not? About getting out of this sick society.
Society, man.
Society. You know, society.
So, I'll start with a disclaimer for this movie. The character in this, Christopher McCandless, I thought was very annoying.
How is this a disclaimer?
Well, I don't think it's fair if, you know, somebody who might like him might like this movie more. And it's kind of, it's part of the movie still. So maybe it's not that much of a disclaimer because if your movie has annoying characters, and I feel bad saying that because it's a real person, but I guess we'll get into that.
That's the thing. Yeah, I'll say up front, he has like living relatives still and everything. And I know that he was a real person. But this is a movie based on a book that a lot of people say is made up anyway. So it's probably pretty far removed from the actual truth. So when we're talking about Christopher McCandless, we're talking about Sean Penn's Christopher McCandless.
Yeah.
And I think my eyes hurt after watching this movie because I had to roll them roughly every 10 seconds because this movie annoyed me so bad the whole time.
It's just too much. It's too, the, more than just, if it was only the character even, you could have a movie where the character acts like he does, and it would still be an interesting movie. But the problem with this movie, I think, is that McCandless acts like he does, and Sean Penn loves it.
Oh, he loves it.
He loves it so much, and he can't get enough of it, and he just, like, this is like hero worship to the nth degree. And it's just, I mean, it's 2.5 hours, and it's just 2.5 hours of Sean Penn saying, isn't this guy, like, cool? Isn't he awesome? And Sean Penn's like, wants
and
to
can't I capture it in, like, a cool, irreverent way?
Yeah.
I feel like Sean Penn was in the movie because his direction was so obnoxious.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's like, he's not in it at all, but I feel him. Which is, like, I've said this before, it's a benefit for the movie. You know, it's a good thing, because I really don't like movies where you can't feel the director at all. Like, I like to know the director is there and guiding me in some way, and some movies just kind of record what's in front of them and have nothing to say about it. But Sean Penn definitely has something to say about this guy, even if it's an annoying thing to say.
It's just such kind of obvious thought behind it of, this kid was a rule breaker, and I'm going to break the rules and telling his story and, like, break the fourth wall and do stupid fast zoom-ins and stuff. And it's got that attitude about it.
Like a punk, like, French movie from the 50s. But it's like Sean Penn, like,
and it's Sean
cool
Penn
kid.
Glorifying this kid that walked into Alaska and starved. And it's so interesting that you say that it's, like, you know, glorifying him and just celebrate hero worship the whole time, because the very first shot gave me hope, because what I thought it was going to be was a bunch of hero worship. But the very first shot was his mother waking up from a nightmare of hearing her son's voice and, like, crying. And I was like, whoa,
yeah,
is this actually going to look at different sides of this and, like, there's things about adventure that are cool, but you can't just abandon your family, and, like, and there's ties that connect you to other people that you can't just sever. But I honestly think, because it's not integrated very well into the film, and it does not explore those themes very much further at all. In fact, it just kind of blames those parents for the rest of the movie for anything bad that happens. I think that might have been done in post or something.
That scene at the beginning?
Yeah, to make it a little less masturbatory about this freaking kid.
Well, I'm glad you were talking about that scene, because there's so many. I think there's so many scenes like that where it seems like, and I don't know if the book was like this or if Sean Penn added these tags to it, but there's so many scenes where it will, it sets up, like, isn't this kid a jerk? But then at the last minute, the movie, like, saves him.
Like, but is he?
Yeah.
Or is he just not subscribing to society's rules?
There's a part where he shoots the moose. He's hungry, and he shoots this moose to try to eat it. But before he can eat it, it has a bunch of, like, flies and maggots and stuff get in it, so he can't eat it anymore.
Because it's an entire moose.
Yeah, so he can't have actually ate it. And for a while, the scene was like, oh man, look what you did, kid. You know, you're illegally hunting.
You don't know what you're doing.
You shoot the moose, and now you wasted that moose's life and all the meat and everything, and you didn't even get to eat anything. And then it shows at the very end, like, just a couple seconds of wolves eating the moose.
And then
it's like,
poetically, like, lamenting taking the life of the moose.
Yeah. He's like, the worst day out here. So I killed that moose. Shouldn't have died. You know, this whole scene sets up this kid being a jerk. And then right at the end, Sean Penn's hand of God pulls him out of the fire. And, you know, and he says some nice little, like, quote.
What could have been such an interesting story of, because this kid has nothing but privilege. Basically, I mean, he's a rich white male. And it could have been such an interesting exploration of he's never had to want for anything, so he wants to know what that feels like. That could be an interesting story, and it could show the pitfalls of it and the, you know, his mistakes that he made and if he learned anything. But it doesn't bother to make it nuanced at all.
He doesn't learn anything, does he?
No, he just like burns his social security card and burns money, and he's just so cool, and he steals a kayak because I don't need permission to go on a river and adventure into, and it, he's just...
The only scene where I felt that was when that he did learn something and that there was actual opposition to his antics was near the end when he is with that older guy. And the older guy takes him, he takes him to Alaska, but he says that if he wants to, when he gets back from Alaska, he would like to be his like grandpa or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the only scene where I felt like it was a little balanced in its worshiping of McCandless.
You know? A little,
yeah. But it's the only inkling of it at all. And maybe it was just that old guy's performance.
I think it was. I honestly think that old guy's really good acting just gave it more depth.
Yeah.
I think the perfect example of just the fact that Sean Penn had no interest in making this a sad story about a kid that did a dumb thing and was young and had to pay the ultimate price for that mistake. And was there's a note that he leaves when he is perishing in his van in the middle of Alaska. And it says in the movie, it says something along the lines of, you know, wasn't it a beautiful life? And thanks, universe, as he's like looking at the sun, you know. And the actual note that the kid left was, I am dying in here. Oh, God, somebody help me. I don't understand why Sean Penn or, you know, the writers or whatever would choose to just gloss over that little bit.
You want to give it a rating?
F. Okay. I was really annoyed the whole time, and I don't think there's many redeeming factors.
Okay, so I think he was an annoying character, and I wish the direction had gone a little differently. But the there's some really good photography of nature in this movie. And
let's see, nature photography on BBC.
I did think that the, even though the direction was a little try hard, I guess, to be, like you said, like a little punk maybe. I thought it was entertaining for most of the movie. Like it clipped along, the direction knew how to, you know, he knew how to form a just good footage to keep me entertained, and I give it a C. I give it a C.
Oh, blasphemer.
A quick recap on the movies that we reviewed today from our most favorite to our least favorite. Our most favorite was Goya's Ghost. We both gave it an A, thought the story was really good, the writing was really good, everything was really good about this movie. Next is Love and Mercy. I gave it a B and Amanda gave it a C. We liked the scenes in the 60s, but thought that the scenes that took place in the 90s could have been in its own movie. It didn't mesh really well. And for In the Wild, we were really split on this one. I gave it a C and Amanda gave it an F. We both thought that the character was a little irritating and that Sean Penn's direction was misguided, but I liked the photography in it and thought it was at least entertaining. That's all for this show. Thanks for listening, and we've got some movies to go watch.